Welcome everyone to this class for the Shamanic Astrology Mystery School on Mercury. We're here, Daniel Germario and myself, Kaylin Castell, we're here to share with you about, we're almost at the Mercury Station Direct, which will be tomorrow at 6:57 a.m. Pacific Time. Woohoo! I have had people tell me this has been the worst Mercury retrograde they've ever experienced. Not that, I haven't had that experience necessarily, but anyway, they're glad that it's going to be over. So just a couple of quick things. This is the second class in the series that we started this year. The first class was the Saturn in Sagittarius. And so if you haven't had a chance to be a part of that class or listen to it, you can go on the website to figure out how to connect with that class. And then the third class in the series will be, and Saturn just went into Sagittarius at the end of last year. So it will be there for a couple of years. So that's going to be a class that's worth having and listening to for a long time to come. And then on Friday the 13th, love that, we're going to be doing the Uranus last class on the Uranus-Pluto square and kind of looking at what's been going on through all of this. Will be number 7, the final one in the series of 7. And preparing for that, it's going to be right before the eclipse. It'll still be pretty exact at the spring equinox eclipse, so we'll be exploring all those possibilities. And is there anything more you want to say about that, Daniel?
It's just a recapitulation and a recap on everything we've talked about for a good 3-4 years about Uranus-Pluto and trying to get a sense of what's really been going on with this and what we could expect over the next 10 years because of this particular impact. It's just a check-in on it. It would seem to be such an important thing that it's worth paying attention to having its own class again. You and I will be creating a new series later in the year.
Right. What I was thinking is we might even be ready to announce what that series is come the next class.
I agree.
Stay tuned because we're going to be dreaming up some cool stuff for the next.
Well, I know for sure one of them will be, because we're kind of in a habit of this now of having one having to do when Jupiter ingresses into the next sign. So there'll definitely be Jupiter into Virgo. That'll be one of the ones.
Yeah, and I was kind of thinking maybe Saturn square Neptune might be a good one, too.
Yeah. So we'll put our heads together on that.
You will. So stay tuned, everybody. So here we are, ready to jump into Mercury. Daniel, would you like to take it away?
Yeah, certainly. We decided to do two Mercury classes. The reason being that the first one is way more specific and technical regarding the unique features of the Mercury cycle itself, any synodic understanding of the cycle, what Mercury does about every 120 days. And it's all totally based around that body of knowledge associated with the synodic cycle. This particular Mercury class, I guess you could say, is a bit more basic, or in some ways we could say more practical. The intention here is for us to understand more deeply what the intent is of your own Mercury position. One thing that those of you who are listening who have been in the astrology community for a long time will note that Mercury, even though it's one of the original primary 7 elements of a chart, one of the visible planets, is that often relegated to something more minor when compared to like Venus or Mars or the Moon or the Sun. So what we're going to do here is give Mercury a whole lot of attention in a practical and useful way. So the intention of Mercury is this: it's kind of like in the current life. This is the sign of your Mercury position now. The sign of Mercury is what version of cognition, communication, or perception that you came into the current life to investigate. So it's a statement of intent. A statement of intent. And it always is understood in comparison with the moon position. Now, so if you have any given moon position contained within that tribe, or the job in that tribe, is a certain approach to perception, cognition, and communication. And that's inherent in you. It's your instincts, attitudes, habits, possibly addictions. But anyway, it's the usual approach a person would have toward thinking, communication, and cognition, and so on. So what the Mercury position is, primarily first, and we're looking at it here through sign, is now kind of like what software have you been issued for the current life? You know, what version of thinking, perception, and communication are you now working with? And is it different than your old one? Is it similar? And then actually you can add on other things like, well, what house is it in, or what aspects are to it? You know, does it have Saturn on top of it? I mean, those are refinements and transmissions to it. But the elements, the essence of it would be what we're looking at as far as the four elements and the way in which we understand the mystery schools themselves that Mercury finds itself in. And those of you who are listening have received, Kaylin sent out a handout that you can actually be looking at, which would make your understanding of what we talk about here today a little easier, about fire, water, earth, and air, what they relate to, and how it relates to left brain, right brain, masculine, feminine, and so on. And that's what we're going to spend a little time talking about right now, and you can be looking at the chart as we go along. As part of this call, we will also speculate a little bit about what the nature of the current Mercury cycle is. We chose this time period to do this call also to ceremonialize the fact that Mercury is about ready to begin a new overtone, the Aquarius overtone. Maybe at the end of our comments here, we can come back and explore that and how it applies to people. How it applies to your own lives. I mean, you may yourself be in a Mercury return, which is the Aquarius overtone, if you happen to be a certain age over the next 120 days. More about that later. So any opening comments you might have to make here before we start diving into the four quadrants of Mercury?
No, I think we're good.
So, while the doctrine of the four elements, fire, air, water, and earth, with always, by the way, the assumed fifth, you know, the assumed fifth is always there, which used to be called ether, but it's like the spaciousness out of which the four operate. The four elements are woven all through astrology. You know, we could be looking at the elements associated with the signs, the elements associated with any planet. But I have found over the years that using putting our attention on the elements when looking at Mercury is the most powerful way of really understanding the elements, is by looking how it operates, how it operates together with the Mercury position. So here's some core issues first, some sort of basic foundational issues. We are using in this in shamanic astrology the ancient alchemical understanding of how the elements operate. They start at earth, they ascend to water, they go up to air, and they go even further up to fire. So there's a density to a refinement, where earth is the greatest density and fire is the most subtle. So if you looked at it from one angle, then you would say earth is ascending to fire, earth through water, through air, through fire. And this would be called evolution, going toward fire and air, earth and water going toward fire and air, the path of evolution, getting out of density, and moving toward refinement. And this has been, in more recent times, defined as masculinity. And in the astrological community, fire and air are in fact masculine, and earth and water are in fact feminine. But we also, in shamanic astrology, want to avoid the view that somehow evolution is all there is. Because there's an equal and important force called involution. And involution is spirit into matter, being embodied, fire and air, spirit, consciousness, going into water and earth, which we could define as the journey of the feminine. It's kind of like saying the feminine begins in spirit, and its journey is down and in into incarnation. The masculine journey begins in the earth, and then its journey is up and out, going toward spirit, toward fire and air. I should just make an incredibly important aside here. We are not in any way talking about men and women. We're talking about archetypal masculine and feminine, and which we're defining as evolution and involution. Now, how does this all relate to Mercury? So, for example, we could take the Earth-Mercury positions. So, if you have Mercury in Capricorn, Virgo, or Taurus, then we're looking at a version of communication, of cognition and perception, that is entirely about bringing spirit into matter. Jung referred to this as the sensation function, earth-based sensation function. So we could say it's thinking that operates through the kinesthetic, thinking that happens through the touch, the senses, the embodiment of the mind, the thinking operating through the sensation function. It's also been understood historically that this earth quality is left brain. It's analytical. And you can actually get a sense of that when you think of particularly the signs of Capricorn and Virgo. In fact, we've generally defined the earth signs as being about bringing spirit into matter, but for three different reasons. So a Virgo brings spirit into matter in order to appreciate, to honor, to worship, to ceremonialize its pattern. So it's kind of like the honoring and the worshiping of the creation and seeing its pattern. Capricorn is more about knowing how it works, the management of it, sacred geometry. And then Taurus is about enjoying it. So you can imagine the enjoyment of the mind in the body. So spirit into matter, the kinesthetics of the mind, or the mind itself operating through the sensation function. I think most people can generally more easily relate to what the sensation function, what the earth function, and this whole concept of bringing spirit into matter is about. And we can see how the earth signs kind of operate that way. But now imagine, what if a person had like Aquarius moon, or a person had Gemini moon, or like if they have one of these air moons, or even a fire moon, and then they have Mercury in one of these earth signs. I mean, that's a pretty big change of gears. The intent is to move in a different direction. Okay, so this is where knowledge of the whole chart gives incredible clues. So we could say the intent is to learn more about the Mercury position, and to move away from where the thinking would have been relative to the moon. Can you think of anything else to add to in this part of our conversation regarding the Earth ones?
I think you pretty well covered it. At some point, do we want to add in something about the sun and how that influences it as well, or wait for that, or not do that?
I can mention about that. Sure. It's sort of like when we teach about Venus, that two-fifths of people will have Venus and the sun in the same sign. And then there's no ambiguity as to what version of the goddess is being explored. There's actually even more people who have the sun and Mercury in the same sign. And when the sun and Mercury are in the same sign, then there's really such a certainty, such an overwhelming clarity about what version of mind, what archetype of the mind is being explored in the current life. It's kind of like that Mercury position is burning its own fuel.
Daniel, do you have something?
No, but I'm hearing a click there, but I don't know where it's coming from.
I can't figure it out either. It's very bizarre.
But I'm not cutting out yet, am I?
No, you sound great. It's just that funky thing in the background. I don't know what that is.
I don't either. That's probably the NSA. Huh? You never know. Hi, guys. Anyway, where was I? So whenever Mercury happens to be in a different sign than the sun sign, then we have an example of where that characteristic or quality of mind that a person has come into the life to investigate is truly individualistic. I mean, it stands separate from anything about sun sign material. I mean, it's really a unique leading edge expression. It's an individuated expression, which then can be modified or altered by the month we're born into or the sun sign. You know, so if a person, for example, had Mercury in Virgo, a tremendously sort of a cool, analytical, and rational place for Mercury, but it happens to be in the sign of Libra. You know, then we do get an additional possibility that Mercury position is much more likely to need to know how to talk to other people, you know, to be more in contact with the more mainstream view or views, rather than that extremely precise and perceptive type of approach the mind uses when it's in Virgo. That's just one example. We could give like hundreds of examples of that, and we'd be hopeful that those who are listening, and particularly if anyone is calls in later, you know, we can kind of give you some clues about how to interpret your own position. I've noticed, by the way, I'm not sure about you, Kaylin, but it's the same thing in our experience in the school with how many people have Venus different than the sun sign. That seems to be beyond statistical probability. You know, that there's actually more individuation with the Venus position. Well, I've noticed the same thing with Mercury, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually something that might be useful to look at in our webinar class, too.
Yeah.
You know, like whether it is actually beyond statistical probability, whether Mercury has individuated or is different than the sun sign. Right.
Mm-hmm. And I know you and I both have the sun sign different than our Mercury.
Yes, yes. And most of the people I know, that's the situation. So as we're moving up, we're going on in the journey of evolution, then we see the three water sign ones. Now, water... and a lot of shamanic astrology has been inspired by Jung's work And, of course, Jung was inspired by original alchemy. So there's kind of this chain that goes back to the way the alchemists understood the elements. And so what Jung called water was the feeling function. Words are important, but also words can really be confusing if you don't know exactly how you're using the word. So often in common use of language, the word feeling and the word emotion are interchangeable. Oh, feelings and emotions, you see. Well, we want to kind of clear up that view, or try to change that view. Everyone can have emotions as a reaction against events. Emotions can fly out all the time. I mean, maybe some people are more emotional than others. But like a lot of times, people with lots of fire can seem to be more emotional than anybody because they react really strongly to events. But that's a different issue than the feeling function. The feeling function is a right brain approach. It's a way that a human being, it's a way in which mammals, I mean, sometimes it's been referred to as the mammalian heart. It's the way in which we react instinctively and automatically to things like to love, to protection, to compassion, to empathy. It's actually the source of values, the source of our values. And it arises in a non-linear and a non-rational way. I mean, and we're not trying to say it's better than anything else. It just operates in a particular way. In fact, too much feeling function is not particularly helpful. I mean, you could think of, say, Mercury in Pisces, and maybe the caricature of Mercury in Pisces is, you're driving down the road and there's some roadkill, and then you can't function for the next 6 hours. You know, I mean, it's like overwhelming, but then that's the opposite of like the individual who doesn't feel anything. You know, the person who's detached continuously and doesn't tune into to those kinds of experiences. So every one of them has in it a balancing function. You know, too much of one or too little of one. But if you have Mercury in a water sign, the intention is to learn that quality, to have the mind operate through the feeling function, through that capacity to connect in spontaneously and in a right brain, automatic way with values and feeling. Like Cancer, for example, Mercury in Cancer. What version of feeling is that? I mean, it's that sort of that kind of thing that on a positive level shows up when we want to protect our children, when we want to protect our family, we want to defend our clan, our tribe. Again, it's like that mammalian heart. It could be said that lizards and reptiles don't have this, okay? They wouldn't know what the feeling function is. It is also said that individuals that are trained in as the elite, you know, sort of the elite sons and daughters that go to the, you know, the top level Ivy League schools and so on, are actually trained in the intellect, but are purposely not trained in the feeling function. You know, I mean, that's like, I know that's probably part of a conspiracy theory there, but it's actually quite. You can start to see it, you know, when you have these incredibly intelligent people, but they do not have any seeming connection to the feeling function. It's as if they're trying to elevate and dominate with the air quality, but not the but leave out the water quality. But if you have Mercury in a water sign, the intent is to investigate, to have the mind operate through the feelings, which sometimes can actually confuse the mind a lot. You know, I mean, it's like air, and you know, the mind itself is thought of as being air. Thinking is air. I mean, one of the four elements is called thinking. So we're referring to Mercury as the symbol of thinking, but it can operate in these other elements. So if it operates in water, air might say, well, geez, that doesn't really, I can't think clearly if I have the feelings in the way, see. But that's the intent if you have in a water sign. Now, there's another element to this, which is that in the division into four elements, there's three that are water: Pisces, Cancer, and Scorpio. But that Scorpio is kind of like the odd one out, because Pisces and Cancer are the feeling function, so much connected with our tribe, our clan, others, how others are feeling, merging. Like the problem with Pisces, sometimes the mind doesn't know whether it's your feelings or somebody else's feelings. It's a classic situation. But it, with Scorpio, it's like a whole other dimension. It's your feelings. You know, it's like the feeling function from a place of self-interest. Depending on what your moon position is in, that can be a little scary. You mean I really have to feel what I'm feeling and to really have it be about my feelings? Wouldn't that be selfish? So these are some of the issues that can come up with Mercury in a water sign. There's also the another angle to this would be that if a person has Mercury in Pisces or Cancer, then you can get lost in the feelings of others. Pisces, pretty much everybody. Cancer, well, my clan, my family, my children, my group. But it's not your own. But with Scorpio, you at least have the capacity to have your own boundaries, to be able to keep it connected to what your own will is, shall we say. And so that's why Mercury and Scorpio can be really good for, you know, like going into the depths and having it together, holding it together to go into the depths, the deep sea diver into the psyche. Also, you know, the usual things we would see with Scorpio: intensity, passion, it's very different flavor than the feeling function of Pisces or Cancer, but still it's the feeling function, the mind operating through feeling. And again, not emotion, but feeling. Did I drop off?
No, you're good.
Okay. Whatever was in the background there shifted. So I'm a little paranoid about it.
I understand, Daniel.
All right, so that's looking at Earth up to water. So why don't we move now into air? The planet of thinking in its own element thinking. The thinking function. Now, the thinking function is like Earth, left brain, analytical. And we're going to see one of the biggest distinctions between air and fire in the way that allegedly science operates. You know, so we'd say that the air Mercuries are gathering the data. You know, analytically gathering all the data, putting it all together, getting all the statistics together, having the mind pick up on as much as possible, and then allegedly there is a conclusion that's drawn from that after studying it for a long time. Fire, on the other hand, is you grasp it immediately, even though both of them have to do with consciousness, both of them have to do with the mental realm. One is right brain, one is left brain. So fire gets it entirely, and some would say that true science, you know, the real innovations that have happened scientifically, happened through fire, not through air. Or it's that great story about Einstein, you know, he sort of got the theory of relativity, and then he had to use the left brain to come up with a type of math where he could explain it to people. So it's not like he got it by the math first.
And wasn't he looking up at the clouds and sort of daydreaming when the whole thing dropped in for him, like very much not in a
right.
left brain mental process, but more in a, just a right brain kind of being present process. So.
Exactly. And then much of the innovations that happen are that way. So they both though are in the quote masculine dimension. You know, they both are spirit going up, earth and water going up and out, the journey of evolution going towards spirit. Air being the left brain version of it, and fire being the logos itself, the grasping of the truth. Very fast initially. Those of you who are listening, you can look at that handout. Some key words have been put in here about the difference between left brain and right brain qualities. You know, so fire and water, right brain. Imaginative, creative, symbolic, figurative, metaphoric. The conceptual is a little tricky. As long as one would recognize that it is coming indirectly, you know, because you can actually have data and come up with a concept, right? But this is something that just kind of drops in from elsewhere. It grabs you. While the left brain is rational, logical, organized, analytical, literal, factual, it's linear, I guess you could say. well, right brain, there is no linearity to it. The fire being more refined, it's higher, it's at the top of the pyramid, as it were, while air is just below it. So if we look at them individually, we would have the different air ones. It's interesting that when we look at the triplicities, just as with water, there was like an odd one out. You know, you have the Pisces and Cancer, and then you have in a very different expression of feeling being Scorpio. The same thing with air. You have the extremely well understood and clearly perceived left brain mental consciousness data information Gemini and Aquarius approach. But what about Libra? I mean, so Libra is more associated with other people, with the way other people think. It's relational with the mind, while Gemini and Aquarius are not so much that. I mean, Aquarius and Gemini are the ones that, without any question, we could say could operate even without a body. I mean, it's just the love, and the love of the mind is unleashed, and the difference between the two, and maybe we can have open up a whole different conversation here, which would be the approaches that each Mercury position would have to self-realization, or how the mind can take us to a place of freedom. So what's the difference? What's the way in which Aquarius does it and the way Gemini does it? Well, the way Aquarius does it is to be able to develop the eye behind the eye, the witness, the high-flying eagle, the thing that just notices everything, reminding me of something that in the people who have written books about insight, about vipassana meditation. They'll say, yes, the path of enlightenment is to get to your mind's awareness to the point of notings per second. If you could note 1,000 things in 1 second, well, then the whole thing falls away. You know, it's like you then see the rising and falling of the whole universe as having no substantial basis of which underneath it there is only pure consciousness. I mean, that would be the Aquarian intent, to go that high, that far out, you know, so there's that amount of spaciousness and cosmic overview. Gemini, on the other hand, while the goal may be the same, it's more like a Zen koan. It's like busting the mind of its tendency to look in dualities and polarities. It's the freedom to go beyond dualities and polarities. But as most people with a fair amount of Gemini know, that you have to go through duality and polarity to get to that point. So that's kind of the goal of the process. Well, I think probably with Libra, it's to be able to have that communication of shared ideas and shared ideals, to be mirrored accurately by another human being, to be gotten so that that other individual really gets what your mind is getting. You know, it's like it requires a person. The other two don't require people. So that would be the air dimension. Anything you want to add at any point, Kaylin?
Okay. I'm getting a little feedback, so I'm trying not to talk too much.
Oh, you're getting feedback on your end.
Can you hear it?
Uh-oh.
Oh, well, then maybe it's okay. I can hear it, though. So.
I wonder, do you think it might help if I called in again, or?
No, I don't think so. I think you sound really good, so, and I'm not hearing it now, so I don't know what's going on.
Okay, so that's just a little taste of the air Mercuries. And again, remembering, I mean, if you're listening and you have one of these air Mercury positions, then relate it to your moon. Is it similar to the element of the moon? Is it similar? I mean, if whatever the sign of the moon you have, imagine Mercury in that sign. And then compare Mercury in that sign with the Mercury position you actually have. And then you'll see the progression, the evolution of what version of mind you used to have and the one you're working on now. So if we then move up in the evolutionary journey, again, we're doing this from earth up through water, up through air, up through fire. Certainly not saying one is better than the other, but we're following the path of evolution. We could have done it the other way. We could have started with fire and gone down to air, to water, and down to earth, the path of involution. With fire, we have what is called the intuitive function. Now, here's another area where we have to be very careful about how we use words. Mm-hmm. So the intuitive function is used here in a Jungian sense as fire, not in the common parlance of like, well, gee, that person has a really good intuition, which sometimes a person is actually referring to the fact that they have really deep feelings. They can feel into the truth of something, or they can feel your feelings. You know, so there can be like a confusion about the use of this word. What we're meaning by intuition is like being the tip of the arrow, the tip of the spear, to go into the unknown, to be confident that you are at the edge, and you don't have to think about it first. It's like getting something immediately. I imagine if you look at the three fire signs, you know, you could imagine maybe on one level, at least Aries, maybe Aries together and with Leo, they might think, well, I'll get there fastest, you know. I mean, I'll get there most dramatically. But all three positions of Mercury there have a certain reputation. You know, they shoot from the hip. They think, well, the thinking is so fast that the action follows so quickly that it looks like they haven't thought before they've acted. And I guess you could say from the perspective of the thinking function, they haven't. In fact, fire is not intended to think before they grasp the whole of a situation. You know, it comes to like trusting the truth as it comes in. The Aries approach, it's unbridled. I mean, it's you just speak the truth. Same for Sag. You know, it's like in the astrological tradition, the Mercury in Sag position has sort of a reputation for being they can't stop telling the truth. You know, I mean, even if nobody's interested I don't want to hear that anymore. You know, so
and sometimes it's their version of the truth, and maybe not somebody else's version of the truth, so it can create some conflict.
And thank you for saying that, because it's not like we're elevating any of these as being good or bad. They all have their shadow side. Just as I was mentioning in the feeling function, sometimes too much feeling function will prevent a person from even being able to function. Too much thinking function, you know. I mean, those are the individuals who are continually perceived of as being lost in their heads all the time. You know, too much Aquarius, you know, like they're out of their bodies. What are we going to do to bring them back? You know, too much Gemini, it's like, you know, you're not interested at all at what's real. You're just interested in more data and information, and you're curious about everything. And, you know, and it's like you can have a story for everything, but what does it have to do with anything? Fire, you know, Sagittarius. It's like I'm continually just going to fly off and tell you what's coming. The first thing that comes to my mind, you know, which may be that individual needs to develop another characteristic also, you know, some objectivity as opposed to just flying off the handle. But having said that, if your Mercury position is in Sagittarius, let's say, or in Aries, which are intended to be these logos, get it fast, be the tip of the arrow, go into the unknown, be the one who's supposed to do that, then there's got to be some support for that, you know, rather than to be completely, totally critical of it and cut it off at the pass. Is to be promoted in a way where that individual, you know, will then not be punished for it, but to get some good training for it would be a way of putting it.
Maybe some feedback that's not necessarily, as you said, punishing, but could give them a sense that it, you know, that it might be good if they took a moment to ponder what it is that they're going to say before they say it. Yeah.
Right. Which is why Jung had the theory of the inferior function, you know, so that there would be an element that is the missing element if you're too much with one. And I don't necessarily, I'm not a doctrinal Jungian. I don't necessarily follow everything he described about this, but certainly if a person has a huge amount of fire, it would be useful for them to have some objectivity also. Or if a person has a huge amount of fire, but you know, a lot of fire people don't have the capacity to get any results. You know, so maybe they need a little earth, you know, like to bring the sensation function in. You know, the combination of these things, which can be perceived through the relationship between the moon, again, and Mercury, you can get a sense of what kind of alchemy a person's life is about. So, Kaylin, I believe, like, for example, you have Mercury in
Aquarius,
and your moon is in Sagittarius. So now those two are more similar. That's like the intuitive function, big view, exploratory Sagittarian mind, and then the Aquarian cosmic overview, objectivity one.
Right. And I often have the experience of, you know, what I like to describe, this is probably more from the fire aspect, but there's just sometimes I know something, I don't know how I know it, I just know it. Mm-hmm. It's not logical, it's not rational, it didn't come through a linear process. And so I think those are my more Sagittarian moments when that happens. And then other times it's like I really have to go through a whole linear logical process to get a sense of what's happening.
And then, I mean, for me, I mean, my Mercury lineage is this Capricorn moon, right? You know, the Taurus tribe and the Capricorn tribe. And if I'm totally in that modality, well, then I am the professor. You know, where it's like the one who just loves information and knowledge as a teaching. You know, I can't learn anything just to be curious about it. I got to teach it, you know, and then, you know, become the authority on the subject. I mean, that's the old one. At a bad day, it's really stuffy and professorial. But then I have Mercury in Scorpio. And that's the passion of the mind. You know, why would I even use my mind if it wasn't a turn-on? If it wasn't something that pushed the boundaries, that caused reactions, that pushed things to the edge and beyond. I mean, that would be the scorpionic impulse with the mind. So anyway, those are just some examples. And if we go back to the fire Mercury's, the Leo Mercury or the Sagittarian Mercury, you know, they're the ones that really get to call it out for others. You know, they're modeling it for others. They're the ones taking the risks. And I can remember this statement at one point. John Lennon of the Beatles was asked at one point, you know, during those glory days when you were at the cutting edge and the leading edge of the creative processes in music, did you have a sense that you were doing something other people weren't doing? And his answer was very interesting, very much the intuitive function. He said, "We know, it's like I thought we were all on this ship together, but we were the ones that got to be in the crow's nest." So they were the ones that got to call it out, but we were all like on the ship together. You know, that's a really good example of the function of the fire sign Mercury's. All right, so that gives you a good, hopefully a good sketch of the way we look at the elements through the Mercury positions.
Daniel, I have one thought that might be useful to share, and this is for people who are looking at, you know, how does communication happen between people? And oftentimes knowing this piece, and especially say if somebody is, they've got a really quick mind and they get some, you know, they get information very quickly and assimilate it very quickly, air and fire. And then they're talking to somebody with an Earth, you know, that's Capricorn, Taurus, or Virgo, Mercury, or a lot of Earth just in general, then it may take them a while to catch up. And this is something Peter and I have been, because he's a Taurus moon, I'm a Sag moon. He's got Mercury in Cancer, and I have it in Aquarius. So I'm like very quick, but it takes him a while to assimilate and process and catch up to where I'm at. And knowing that, it's like I don't take it personally, and he doesn't take it personally that I'm just, you know, right, out there just saying what I'm saying really quickly. We understand how each other works, and so there's space for that.
Once you did recognize that was what was going on.
Right,
and
exactly.
That's the great value of this. I mean, and you'll notice that what you've just described is the reverse of the way they usually in pop psychology talk about men and women together.
Yes.
You know, where they'll say that, well, men are the ones that are just, you know, going for it fast, and they need to just wait a while and let the woman process it, you know?
Right. Yeah, we are exactly opposite.
Yeah. And this is
so
a great
it's very
example.
Helpful information in relationships and looking at how people process their information and what's really true for them, and then not taking it personally if you are opposite of how somebody else is operating through that mental process.
Another good example, Kaylin, is, you know, my former wife, Debbie. I mean, you know, she was Mercury in Sag, and I'm Mercury in Scorpio. And so when we were going at it sometimes, we'd be having these wild horses debates, you know, and people think that you didn't let me finish. Well, I don't care if you. Well, we just don't have to. We can finish each separate sentences, or you butt in. You know, you're
right.
You know, completely. You know, wow, that just came to my mind now. If I don't get to say it now, I'll forget about it. You know,
so, right.
Wild horses. You know, and people were arguing. You know, but that's just the way we were communicating.
And it worked. So that's the thing. So, you know, as long as you figure out how to make it work, that's what's important.
But if you happen to be that kind of an individual, and then you're with somebody with Mercury in Libra, well, then, you know, you can really have some problems. That person is convinced you'll never, ever learn to listen to them.
Right.
So we're looking at all these different approaches, and that is a very practical application of how this works in relationships, for sure. Now, of course, there's other ways of modifying our understanding of our Mercury position. You know, so if you have a Saturn to it or Pluto to it or some of the outer planet complexes will alter It'll be like a different transmission, a different contribution, we could say, that is made to the archetype.
It adds another perspective, mm-hmm. Based on whatever outer planet it might be to that.
I mean, if a person had Mercury in Sagittarius or, one of the right brain ones, let's say, you know, one that's sort of wild and uninhibited and the wild horses one, as it were, and then you have Saturn on top of it.
Right. Very different.
On a bad day, it's like, this is horrible. I'm being punished for being this. But on a good day, it's like a really magnificent contribution. It's adding a certain structure, you know, a certain, it slows it down a little bit, you know. It allows it to actually get something done.
And yes, to help bring those brilliant ideas into a manifest form that's useful and works. The other thought I have is, like, say you had Mercury in Virgo with Uranus conjunct.
Yes, right. Yeah, which is giving it a spontaneous wildness to it, which wouldn't normally be there.
It gives us an opportunity to connect to a bigger perspective, a broader point of view as well, so that it's not so just in that linear left brain process.
Mm-hmm. Another good example to be able to perceive the distinction between the elements, like there's two, for example, that are both left brain, one air, one earth, the Aquarian left brain, air, and the Virgo left brain, earth. Well, they do have interesting similarities, but they also have a difference that is so extreme that you could actually write a whole book on that difference. It's like too much Virgo, they say, is you cannot see the forest for the trees. You know, so therefore you have total concentration on all the details and the pattern you're looking at, and you might miss the larger pattern. With Aquarius, they'll say you cannot see the trees for the forest. You know, so you basically have this cosmic overview left brain pattern, but you please do not slow me down by having to look at details. But when those two operate together, then you have a supreme rationalist. Aquarius moon, Mercury in Aquarius moon, Mercury in Virgo, or something like that.
Right. Or Uranus conjunct the Mercury, or can also add that as well. Yeah.
Now we could add in here at this point a little bit about the when these positions really switch on. I mean, if we're trying to say that the intention is, if you know your Mercury position, that's what you're here to work on, to develop. It's like a set of instructions. There are going to be certain times in our life when there's a greater opportunity for it to switch on. And those are the things we did touch on a little bit in the previous Mercury class. And you might want to reference that at some point when you're researching Mercury more. And that's the so-called Mercury returns. H7, H13. There's a whole series of dates that are when the Mercury position returns to its original place closest to the birthday. It's kind of like a recreation of the original set of instructions with regards to Mercury. And it's a time period only about 120 days long, so I'm bringing that up now because we are entering into the beginning of the 120-day or so period, which is the overtone Aquarius. I'm looking at my chart right now on it. Tomorrow, when Mercury stations direct, is the beginning of the Aquarius overtone. And it runs from February 11 until June 11th, 121 days. And during that time, Mercury will do all the stuff that it does in this overtone. from morning star to disappearing behind the sun to evening star to the beginning of the next retrograde phase. And again, I don't want to recapitulate all those portions of the Mercury story now, but what I'm bringing up about it now is the fact that some of you who are listening may be Mercury in Aquarius overtone, or you may be in your Mercury return cycle.
That would be me.
I was going to say, I think you are, yes?
Yeah. Although my overtone actually is, because it was early degrees, it's 27.5 degrees Capricorn, but Mercury is stationing direct at 1 degree Aquarius, so it's within very close, and it will be very close on my birthday to be exactly the same degree it was when I was born. So it's definitely my return cycle because it's happening, you know, it's a nod.
Have you, Caitlin, have you had the opportunity to go back to all of them and to see which ones are Capricorn and which ones
Capricorn.
Are Aquarius?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great idea. I have not done that yet because I shared this with you, Daniel, not too long ago because we just created a new Mercury table. Thank you, Matthew James, who did that. And for a long time we looked at when it was conjunct the sun, and then we realized that really the time to start the cycle was when it stationed direct. And so we hadn't created new tables for that yet. And I had never gone back and looked at when it stationed direct. I just assumed it was in Aquarius. So I was thinking I had an Aquarius overtone for all these years and just realized within the last couple of months that I have a Capricorn overtone. That was a big assemblage point shift for me.
Well, I was wondering about this because recently I'm in preparation for our joint Venus-Mars class.
Yes.
I finally looked at, in my Venus returns, which gate I was at, right? You know, and sometimes it was fourth and sometimes it was fifth. And the pattern of how that shifts. Well, when you're kind of on the boundary here, the borderline, to look at, say, each of the six, seven, you know, the certain time periods where every six years, where you have the possibility of Mercury coming back to its original point really close to your birthday, you know, the different major and minor Mercury returns, which ones were Capricorn and which ones were Aquarius. It might be interesting to get clues on that.
I will do that. I'm excited, because this is my overtone right now, my Mercury return, so it's a good time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the next 120 days for people who are like 46, 33, 52, 59, 65, 66, 26. There's different ages that are more likely to be the ones where you'll be in your return. And the way to check is just look in the ephemeris and see whether at your birthday, if you happen to be born in the next 120 days, if your birthday is... if your birthday... is within the next 120 days, look and see how close Mercury is on your birthday to where it was when you were born.
See, basically what people want to do is look at, to where Mercury went direct prior to their birthday. And sometimes you'll be looking back maybe a few days, maybe a few weeks, maybe as much as almost 4 months. As in Daniel's case, because, you know, he was born in October, and July 5th, 1948, was when Mercury stationed direct in Gemini. So that's a few months prior to his birthday.
Right, and that's because I was born at the point just after it went retrograde.
Right.
You know, so it's near the end of the cycle, rather, in your case, I'm relatively close to the beginning, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's all part of the thing we detailed in the previous Mercury class about the meaning of where you're born in the cycle. You know, psychopomp, Apollo, hermetic, shapeshifter, guardian of the threshold, and all those things. Let's look at what would be... I thought of another thing. So why are we beginning it at the stationary direct point. Well, this much of this has to do with the capacity to visibly see Mercury. Unlike Venus, which is very dramatic when it rises as a heliacal rising star in the morning, and you can really see why they would begin a cycle with that, because of the mercurial and shape-shifting quality of Mercury, you can't always depend on when you're going to see it. And the, what the Babylonians did is that they decided that their tables were based upon the point when Mercury was direct. They didn't try to look at it as when did you get to see it as a heliacal rise. And also, I have been somewhat not interested in the more recent tradition of looking at the conjunction, the invisible point, as the beginning of a cycle. That's why we begin that our understanding of the new moon is not the sun-moon conjunction, but when you can see the first crescent. So combining all of those factors leads us to now work with the beginning of the cycle being when Mercury goes direct, because that's when you would actually have visibility for sure as morning star. So that's today, tomorrow, as the beginning of the cycle. And then that's the Aquarian overtone of Mercury making its play on the world stage. We were talking about this during the monthly call, that we think we were speculating that what would be the real purpose of the Mercury retrograde time in Aquarius, which some people have been having a lot of trouble with. Well, maybe the intention is to convince people that there's value in going into a level of Aquarian mind that is the eye behind the eye, the witness consciousness, the cosmic overview, as opposed to being attached to the lower octave of Aquarius, in my opinion anyway, which is, that is to say, silicon technology. So maybe one of the very best time periods to have a fast from technology would be the Mercury and Aquarius overtone.
Yeah.
That's just a possible suggestion. As best that we can do that. I mean, I don't know. It might be for many of us that have responsibilities, it might be very difficult to take the 120 days and just say, this is when I'm, you know, not going to have any connection to the web.
But, you know, people could take a day or, you know, a few days, or maybe go camping somewhere and, you know, not take technology with you or something. So you could still find a way to disconnect for a short time, even if you can't do it for the whole time.
That would be the Scorpio approach to it, you know. The whole 120 days, yes. But,
right.
But I agree. You know, it's just taking a little doses of it, you know, just to remember that other version of consciousness that's not the man-made, the World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm. Right. So just something I want to let everybody know is that the Mercury table that I mentioned will be posted. I think it's not yet posted, but will be posted by February 13th when we plan to launch the new members' website. And so you can find that table. You'll be able to find your Mercury overtone or anybody you want to look up from on that table that will be there. So that's an easy way to do it. Or you can also, if you have an ephemeris, it's really easy to look it up that way as well. But just wanting to let people know that there is a table from 1915 to 2063 that is going to help people to see where Mercury stationed direct before their birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So they can get a sense of what that overtone is. And that's something we also do incorporate, and that we talked a little bit about, or quite a bit about, in the other Mercury class, was how that adds another flavor to your Mercury, the overtone, as well as, you know, what sign the sun is in and where your moon is and what other planets you might have to Mercury. So it just adds another dimension to look at to help you understand it.
Yes, the place you are in the 120-day cycle, morning or evening star, but also, like, I'll give an example. Like, I have Mercury in Scorpio, and it's retrograde. My overtone is Gemini. And there's five different signs that happened that Mercury went through from the beginning of it until it got to my Mercury in Scorpio position in the cycle. Well, those who know me, I mean, good grief. Gemini, overtone, Mercury, and Scorpio, what am I always talking about? It's, you know, like jazz or complexity or, you know, I'm always going off on this tangent or that tangent, and I try to bring it all back together. I think I do, but it's not just one clear stream. You know, it's like I'm going to bring in this and that feature and that. It's like a dance. It's more like jazz than that sort of crystal clarity of one idea that you carry through all the way. That's one way of perceiving how this operates together. Other individuals are going to have a completely different approach to it, it's just very, very revealing and. And I'm hoping that that there will be some participation in this line of inquiry by those who are listening. If there's anybody out there who would like to participate in this discussion.
So, do you think we're ready to open it up now for questions and comments?
Let me just quickly tune in and see if there was some other element of this that. We wanted to make sure we talked about. Just one other thing. And it's to remember that in this paradigm, and by looking at the Mercury positions, we have a great way of remembering this. There's no good or bad position. This is, of course, a main feature of shamanic astrology, but some people might think, geez, I've got Mercury in Scorpio retrograde, or I've got this Aquarius Mercury, or there might be certain positions that might seem difficult, particularly relative to your moon position, or you might have actually gotten influenced by what the mainstream might say about a Mercury position. You know, God, Mercury in Taurus, geez, you know, I mean, that's a slow cow mind, you know, you can't process anything very fast, you know. The judgments made about good or bad regarding the different positions, throw that out entirely. Every position has its own value, and it is an intention. It's our intention to learn that one. And even if it is different than the lineage, well, that's part of our project. It's part of our alchemy to be able to transform one into another without completely eliminating where we started. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, that's a good reminder.
It's not a bad position.
Mm-hmm.
And it also means it's not bad to have it retrograde.
Right. I know people who have it retrograde that think it's a pretty cool thing, actually, that's it's a blessing for them. They're really happy about it.
I just made this discovery recently that in my new family, my wife, her mother, and her closest three brothers, it's just pretty remarkable. Every one of them is Mercury retrograde. And then I'm Mercury retrograde. You know, we have a whole clan of Mercury retrogrades, you know. So I guess you could say, yeah, they're all also eccentrics and different than normal, too. But that certainly doesn't mean it's bad, you know. Yeah, so let's see if anybody has anything they want to explore.
Okay, so what I think I'll do, if you have background noise, you might want to mute your phone. I will just unmute. We don't have too many people on the call. I'll try that. If there's a lot of background noise, I'll have to mute everybody again, and then do the Q&A. But let's just open it up and see if we've got questions, comments, insights, ahas. I have to hit the... There you go. So, anybody?
I have a question. This is Mary Fullwood.
Hey, hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary. I've had the weirdest Mercury conversation with you guys. I've been, like, I missed the first 15 minutes because I don't have internet, so I couldn't access the code information Eric sent it to me, and then and then AT&T called while you've been on the line. So I've missed almost everything you've said, so I will be listening to the recording. And my real question is, I'm just curious, I have Mercury is conjunct Saturn in Aquarius, and I'm just curious what that means or what that dynamic is when they're Mercury is 13 degrees Aquarius and Saturn is 16 degrees Aquarius.
Yes, yes. Hi, thank you, Mary. I actually had made a comment regarding that. There was a section about the contribution that the planetary complexes make to Mercury.
Uh-huh, great. I'll look forward to listening.
But no, but that's part of our part of this class, so I'm more than happy to comment on it. So the let's say we think of Aquarius as being unbounded and spacious and technically outside of the system of manifestation completely. So the downside of too much Mercury in Aquarius is that it's not really connected into the, quote, real world.
Uh-huh.
So therefore, if you have Saturn with it, at first Saturn on Mercury could give the person the illusion, false message, let's say, that your Aquarian vision isn't good enough. You need to get smarter. It needs to be more practical. It needs to be more grounded. There's something wrong with Mercury in Aquarius, you see.
Huh.
But then later on, the contribution is that it does connect it to the real world. So like Saturn to Mercury in Aquarius to me does have a relationship. It's like a combination of Capricorn and Aquarius. It's sacred geometry itself. It's the way to connect that greatest possible perception of great mystery, which is what the eagle can have, and then brings it into the form the rules and regulations associated with the third dimensional reality that we're actually in.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I've always been curious about that, so thank you for that perception.
Mary, I'm curious of how you experienced school when you were going to school.
I love school. I mean, I'm an education junkie, as you guys, I'm sure, have figured out. Going to school, I don't think I ever, it's actually kind of just saying that, I see Saturn as like the tether for Mercury, and so I feel like I've been pretty good at being able to bring thought into form.
Remind us your moon position, Mary?
It's Aries.
Okay, all right, right. So Saturn in the long run is that which tethers it in a good way. That causes it to be interested in systems and structure and, systems of knowledge rather than, I'm free to be anything I want to be at any moment and, I'll just make it up any way I want.
Right. And I kind of what you were saying, I definitely have the critical edge on, the good enough, smart enough, but it's been a good taskmaster, and it also is good to have your perception of that, so I don't think it's blame it on the culture or blame it on something else, right? And just go, okay, that's just the dynamic I have, right? A self dynamic.
The thing about having the Saturn there, that makes it easier for you to be in the world. I mean, I'm thinking of my former wife who had Aquarius moon and has Aquarius moon and Mercury and Sag. No Saturn. Okay, so here's someone who said, "Why should I ever have to learn the rules of spelling? I'll just do it. I'll just every time I write it."
Very good.
She was very creative in how she spelled things.
Yeah. I can really see the dynamic of Mercury with Saturn then, because I really love editing and
yes. And so what I kept saying to her was that, hey, there might have been an advantage to you. I mean, maybe you could be a wild rebel and do it any way you want, but it might have been helpful to learn the actual rules and then do that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you. This is really, I mean, it's just very helpful to hear those insights.
Thank you, Mary.
Hey, guys, it's Gemini Brett.
Hey.
All right. Yeah, we jumped on. Good.
Another Saturn-Mercury conjunction with someone you mentioned in the call, who's Albert Einstein. And my understanding of the story of how he found his way to the theories of relativity is he was imagining himself riding a beam of light through space. So he's got the Aries-Mercury and a Sagittarius-Moon, so pretty connected to that download.
That's totally our intuition, yes, and beautiful, uh-huh.
Right, and then that comment you were just saying to Mary, you know, Saturn, and he's got Capricorn and Mars as well, but Saturn is Mercury. It's like, okay, I figured this out. Now I got to do some math. I got to make this practical and bring it out to the world. I really like looking at his chart right there and seeing that conjunction. But my conjunction on my chart, I have Gemini Moon, Gemini Rising, as you know, but Libra Mercury. And it's conjunct Pluto within a couple degrees. So I was wondering if you could just speak to that.
Well, yeah, it's. I mean, is it not true that in your brilliance and your connection to multifaceted knowledge, as well as maximum capacity to tell stories, that your challenge sometimes is how to make it accessible so that the greatest number of people can actually enjoy what you're doing?
Certainly. And so what's Pluto do for me in that equation?
Well, it actually ultimately took you to a place of vulnerability about it, you know, and a willingness to kind of go into the powerlessness around it, so that it's not a criticism really of your capacities, but to produce a certain kind of at the Plutonian gift, taking you into a realm of Libra that was sort of unknown to you.
Yeah, probably still is. Do you feel that Pluto adds a Scorpio flavor to the Libra-Mercury?
Of course, yeah. But it's your willingness to look at it and go there.
Brett, have you found that when you are communicating sometimes with people that you wind up being a catalyst for them? Maybe you think you're saying something and then they get catalyzed in a way that you weren't expecting?
Usually I'm doing it on purpose.
Right.
But yeah, absolutely. And that's so much part of my work, you know. And I think going through some, like, pain around relationship, I mean, I see Mercury and Libra somewhat as being that, too, you know, and interest in investigating relationship and the yin and the yang and so much of what my study is now, and needing to kind of fall in the deception of that in, like, almost every way possible. To have some perspective. But then, yeah, so a lot of what I can do as a catalyst is I'm not afraid to share my own, you know, darkness and tragedies and patterns and that kind of thing.
Was that always been the case, or do you feel like that's something you've come more into as you've gotten older?
Oh, it's definitely something I've come more into, at least more into awareness of. And shamanic astrology helps with that so much because being, you know, kind of so air driven, now I have a language for it to funnel through.
It's interesting because I have Mercury and Aquarius opposed by Pluto and Jupiter. So Jupiter makes it bigger, Pluto bigger. Anyway.
You know, it's very interesting, Brad, is that thinking about this, that since you have the Mercury in Libra but with Pluto, right? So I have so much Libra and I'm Mercury in Scorpio. Right. So actually, I have run into the same problem. That's why I sort of know kind of what your predicament might be. I mean, there's any number of times I know that I've gone into these arcane, amazing, deep, powerful riffs about something, and basically I've lost most of the audience.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm building a presentation right now, and the other night I probably put 4 hours into doing all this stuff, and before I was like, wait, nobody wants to hear this. You know, nobody's going to get this. That's coming to this talk. So it got canned, but I'll save it for later. But, Caitlin, what were you going to say about the Jupiter-Pluto opposition?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I, in my younger life, found that I would just say share something innocently and never with the intention of offending anybody or hurting their feelings or whatever, because, of course, I'm also a Pisces sun, so I'm extremely sensitive to all of that. But I would say something that would just totally piss them off, and I would have no idea how I did that or why. And as I've gotten older, there's definitely, it's become a lot easier for me, and I find that I catalyze people in a good way now, not in so much of the negative way. So that was why I was curious as to how you had that experience.
Yeah, well, certainly a shift I've made recently is just getting out of, like, the rabbit hole of conspiracy. I mean, actually, not really, but at least in what I'm communicating, you know, seeing, like, what serves other people and what they're ready to hear. Mm-hmm. So that's been, like, a huge shift, and I felt like that was part of the product of my Pluto square Pluto, and now it's Pluto square Mercury, so it feels like that whole thing is getting evolved.
Yeah. So that's your leading edge. I mean, for you to learn how to do that, the first step is to perceive what the problem was, and then to be able to find your own unique solution to it.
Yeah, thank you. So one other just brief question. It seems that Mercury heliacal rising is really not that far from the Mercury direct point, right?
Because yes, I mean, it's very close.
Do you use 15 degrees for Mercury heliacal?
No, because basically depending on which, whether you're in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere, or whether it's what season, you know, whether it's spring, whether, you know, based on the inclination of the orbit, I mean, it could actually be less than 10 or it could be 20.
Gotcha, yeah. So that's one thing that I'm really working on with Venus right now. Actually, that's the stuff I kind of threw out. But yeah, so that's interesting to hear that's a working model for you with Mercury. And so that's why the direct point was just easier to
way
work with.
I got that inspiration from reading this book about the Babylonian tables and how the way they were tracking the synodic cycle of Mercury, and they weren't even trying to use the heliacal; they were just using the stationary retrograde and direct point. You know, so they said, "Well, okay, if that's using that, you can always count on that."
But Brett, well, there was a time when we did try to use that, and we realized that it was pretty futile. So
yeah.
You know, experimented with it, didn't really, it had to go to something else.
Yeah, well, other people probably have questions, and that's for another talk anyway, but I'm really interested in sharing with you what I'm finding about Venus looking at some of the old Sumerian tables stuff.
So yeah, actually, Brett, this has come up in our joint Venus-Mars class, is that I've actually spent a fair amount of time re-looking at the issue of, like, the gates, you know, about how, like in my own case, half the time in my life it's been fourth and half of the time it's been fifth.
Yeah, I get my first gate shift this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to check in and see if there's anybody else who has a question or a comment they'd like to share.
This is Emma. Comment only. It's been a wonderful class, and I have learned so much from Brett and Mary's questions.
Mm, yes.
Yes, I know. It's so great, and it's wonderful when people do ask questions and we get to learn more.
I was sort of laughing at my combination. I have a Mercury in water and a Moon in Earth, and I look back on my life and I think, how many times have I communicated mud?
Interesting insight.
Brilliant, Emma.
Sometimes.
One thing I would also add, Daniel, just quickly, last time we were talking about Mercury, but a great mythology that kind of fits is Orpheus and, Orpheus descending into Hades to retrieve his bride who was killed. And then he's not allowed to look back at her. And when he does, it all ends.
right? How does that relate, though? How are you thinking that relates?
Well, it's like, in the Mercury cycle, I feel like the retrograde period is then just walking back up the hill out of Hades. And then when he looks and she's snatched away by Hermes, actually, then that's like when Orpheus, he doesn't last long before he's killed. So there's a sense to me that, like, in the Mercury retrograde periods, we're really meant to look back at the last 4 months. You know, since, like in this example, we've been Libra mentality since October 25th when Mercury went direct in Libra. And so it's in this Aquarius retrograde even, it's really the end of the Aquarius cycle.
Of the Libra cycle, right.
So, like, going back through Libra in general. But as far as the mythological portion, I'll write it up because it's too many words.
Actually, no, I agree with you. Actually, as a Mercury retrograde person, that is one of the ways I've understood that particular phase of it, that it's a recapitulation, and it's a digestion and a looking back at everything that's happened in the cycle. Yeah.
Yep. Reviewing.
Mm-hmm. And so I agree with that. Yeah, that's great. And what I just got to mention about something that Emma said, which is that if it's mud, I was trying to say that sometimes mud is sensual and grounding and actually sort of succulent, you know, good mud, you know, getting into mud. There's a certain element. I was thinking about this because I rewatched one of my favorite movies from 1969 the other day called Women in Love, the D.H. Lawrence great movie. And there's these points in the movie where they, in order to get out of their crazy confusion, they went just into the woods and got their hands in the mud. So that sometimes the mind, maybe the mind needs to be in the mud sometimes.
There's also mud is used for detoxing, for pulling out toxins and poisons from the body too. So they can be useful in that way as well.
Yeah. And with a Sagittarian sun, you take that mud and you bake it in the sun and you have building blocks of adobe or clay.
Beautiful.
That's it. Good. I'm glad you're picking up on my my stream there. All right.
Well, I think that we're close to the end of our time here.
Yeah, I think we are too. So.
Is there anything else? Quickly. All right, then I think we're complete. And thank you all. It's been really great. And thank you so much for the wonderful questions and insights and sharing. And we'll hopefully catch you on for the Uranus Pluto square class on March 13th, on Friday the 13th.
Excellent.
Bye, everybody.
Okay, bye.